Right, this is Pure Decking for May 3rd, 1469. This is a show about stuff that interests me. I'm Morps, and tonight all I've got is Analog. I've scared everyone else off.
And I'm on meds.
That's the only reason he's here.
Yeah.
I had to drug him up to get him to agree to do the show. So no need to do dumb question to open things with. The only meds I'm on tonight is Sprite and vodka, or actually citrus drop, but just because I found some of that in the fridge.
Cool.
So it's probably flat, but how can you tell once you've added it to vodka? So
yeah, I mean, at that point, you know, it's doesn't matter if it was fizzy. There's not going to be much fizz left.
No.
As long as you put the appropriate amount of alcohol in it anyway, so.
Three parts to one, so.
Cool.
There we go.
Unfortunately, I can't drink tonight, but.
You shouldn't need to if you've got the little happy pills.
Yeah.
Anyways, just a quick bit of station news. The final I Have Nothing is Saturday. Get on the stream early. We're going to probably be doing some specials since it's the last show. I have absolutely no idea what those specials are. Probably some of the old episodes of IHN, maybe the live episode from Gen Con. It could be nothing but are you making animal noises for an hour? I don't actually know. So we'll work that out, but I wouldn't actually be surprised if it was RU playing with, you know, stuffed animals or something for an hour. But yeah. So also, the next couple of episodes of Pure Decking, we're going to be exploring some alternatives to Skype. So if we have technical issues, just, you know, bear with us. So things tend to get a bit crazy when I start trying to implement new solutions. So yeah. Anyways,
but in the end, it'll be good.
Oh yeah, no. If we can get something that's a little bit easier to work with, and then still link it into Skype, so we can do call in shows. Speaking of call in shows, I actually don't have it in this part of the, you know, in the intro. I've got it in the outro, but losing IHN, we're gonna have some open time slots. So if people have ideas for shows, contact us. We have the time slots to fill. So. I'm going to move right in here to current events. Very first story right off the top. You know, my God, we actually found a judge who understands how networking works. This is from Torrent Freak. Mass BitTorrent lawsuits have been dragging on for more than 2 years in the U.S., involving more than 250,000 alleged downloaders. The copyright holders who start these cases generally provide nothing more than an IP address as evidence. They then ask the courts to grant a subpoena, allowing them to ask internet providers for the personal details of the alleged offenders. The problem, however, is that the person listed on the account holder is often not the person who is downloading the infringing material. Or put differently, an IP address is not a person. Thank God somebody's starting to understand that.
Yeah.
Previous judges who handled BitTorrent cases have made observations along these lines, but none have been as detailed as New York Magistrate Judge Gray Brown was in a recent order. In his recommendation order, the judge labels mass BitTorrent lawsuits as a waste of judicial resources. Hallelujah. For a variety of reasons, he recommends other judges reject similar cases in the future. One of the arguments discussed in detail is the copyright holder's claim that an IP address can identify the alleged offenders. According to Judge Brown, this claim is very weak. The assumption that the person who pays for internet access at a given location is the same individual who allegedly downloaded a single sexually explicit film is tenuous, and one that has grown more so over time. So I guess it was a, you know, one of the porn suits that this guy was actually working on.
Yeah.
An IP address provides only the location at which one of any number of computer devices may be deployed, much like a telephone number can be used for any number of telephones. That, yeah, I hadn't thought of that analogy that, you know, one phone number goes to a house, not each individual phone in the house. So
this is true. Yes.
I mean, I guess that's not as true with cell phones. With cell phones, it's pretty much one number's it. But, yeah, you know, with right. your house phone, it's always been, you know, one number rang a whole house. So I never really thought about it that way before. Yeah. Thus, it is no more likely that the subscriber to an IP address carried out a particular computer function, here being the purported illegal downloading a single pornographic film, than to say an individual who pays for the telephone bill made a specific phone call. The judge continued by arguing that having an IP address as evidence is even weaker than a telephone number, as the majority of U.S. homes have a wireless network nowadays. This means that many people, including complete strangers, if one has an open network, can use the same IP address simultaneously. And that is also true. Somebody got a hold of this judge, either that or he just went home and asked his kids, and said, you know, how do networks work? Oh, there's this little thing called a NAT router, and everything behind it gets the same IP address? Yeah.
Finally a judge that actually has some understanding of what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, and that's true. An IP address does not define a person, especially when you get into things outside of home networks. How many computers at a company are behind one IP? How many computers, if you go to like a library or a place that still has terminals, you don't see it that often anymore, you know, how many of those are behind a single IP? And the, or if you go to someplace that like a Starbucks or like a Barnes & Noble or whatever, where they've got open Wi-Fi, how many people are hiding behind that one place's Wi-Fi that the store has no control of? So
yeah. So I think a couple of things might happen, actually. I think one probably would be they'll try somehow to eliminate everyone's connection without being registered. And then so that way, you know, if that means giving out, you know, multiple public IPs, like, you know, my house, for instance, I have X number of computers. Well, then I have X number of public IPs, and each computer gets its own IP address type thing. Or B, it would be, you know, that if you have, if your Wi-Fi router is open, your carrier will shut your connection down until you secure it, so that, you know, it knows then, and then you are responsible no matter the traffic.
Yeah, sure. Actually, several ISPs already do that kind of thing. They make you sign the agreement that you'll secure your Wi-Fi and that you take claim responsibility for anything coming over it. But yep. that's not a legal standing. That's an agreement between you and the ISP.
Right, but I think what they'll do is they'll expand that.
Probably. I mean, I kind of hate to see them shut down open Wi-Fi or,
you know,
make you get an account with every fucking place you go to get on the internet just so you can be tracked, which is what that is. But at least, you know, at least we're starting to get some judges up there that understand what this stuff actually is and can tell these guys to go pound sand when they show up with an IP address and say, yep, yep, this person was doing something. See, we've got a screenshot right here.
Right, yeah. I think it's good, though, too. It's going to set a precedent, you know, and help a lot of people who are just getting frivolous lawsuits thrown at them.
Oh, yeah, because most people have no clue what to do with these lawsuits, and they come in with the fear language. I mean, I've seen several of these complaint letters, so I know how they work. They're literally out of the bat saying, yep, you were downloading this horrible rap song, and we want $3,000 from you right now, or we're going to file a lawsuit.
Yeah, and people get really scared when they just hear the intimidation of, oh, we're going to file a lawsuit against you.
Oh yeah. No, these letters are horrible. I mean, these are... I had to get an example of one and read it on a show sometime for a Pure Decking or something, because, I mean, these things are just absolutely vicious. They are... It's like, you know, we represent blah, 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 blah. And, I mean, they got all the legal speak in there. And, you know, if you got somebody who doesn't know that much about how the law actually works and doesn't follow this stuff, I mean, I can see getting pretty upset and pretty scared pretty quick and being willing just to turn over a couple thousand dollars to make the problem go away.
Very true.
So, anyways, next story up. This one's from the BBC. File sharing site The Pirate Bay must be blocked by UK internet service providers, the High Court has ruled. The Swedish website hosts links to download mostly pirated free music and video. That's biased. There's a ton of open content on there, too. Anyways, Sky, Everything Everywhere, TalkTalk, O2... TalkTalk, really? Who the hell names... Anyways, O2 and Virgin Media must all prevent their users from accessing the site. Sites like the Pirate Bay destroyed jobs in the UK and undermined investment in new British artists, the British phonographic industry BPI said. Yeah, sure, that's what it does. A sixth ISP, BT, requested a few more weeks to consider their position on blocking the site. BPI's chief executive, Geoff Taylor, said the High Court has confirmed that the Pirate Bay infringes on copyright on a massive scale. Its operators line their pockets by commercially commercially exploiting music and other creative works without paying a penny to the people who created them. This is wrong. Musicians, sound engineers, video editors deserve to be paid for their work like just like everybody else. Well, sure they do, but they are. It's called You're the Ones Paying Them.
That's correct.
And the Pirate Bay, I don't think they're making that much money. I mean, yeah, they've got some banner ads, but that's it.
Yeah. I find it funny that you know, they're all up about these musicians are not making money and blah, 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 blah. You know, if you actually talk to them, let's just take music, okay? We'll focus on one section. Mm-hmm. Because the Pirate Bay, you know, of course, focuses on a ton of different sections. So we'll focus on music.
You can download a car from the Pirate Bay. They've got the plans if you have a 3D printer. I mean, come on.
There you go, right? So music, for instance, I write a song, okay, and I'm with a label, and that label has marketed out the song, and I'm selling it, you know, on iTunes or on, you know, whatever, you know, all the different mediums that I could be selling it at. Okay, so I'm pulling in stuff from there. However, you know, yeah, sure, it may get pirated out, and someone pirates that song, but, you know, they like it so much, they go and buy the album.
Well, maybe not so much the album, because the artist doesn't make that much money from the album. But maybe they decide, hey, I'm going to go see that guy in concert next time.
That's the other thing, too. Yeah, I mean, like I said, multiple avenues of revenue are still available to the artist. And so they're not losing money.
Well,
there's no way they're losing money.
Yeah, and if you think back on it, before things got so crazy with copyright, I seem to remember reading lots of articles about how radio stations actually used to get paid by the labels to play their music as advertisement to go buy the disc or whatever, right?
Yep.
So I fail to see how this is different than a radio station just simply, you know, giving away the music for free to advertise it.
No, I think also to, you know, talk about losing money, it's not people pirating it. It's the economy right now.
Oh, yeah, the economy's in the shitter. But so. it's the thing is, music sales, statistically, music sales aren't down, they're up. It's just that the companies represented by, you know, these industry groups are losing profit. You've just got new companies coming up. That's called how the free market works.
Yep.
So, but just to finish out the story here, on November 2011, the BPI asked a group of ISPs to voluntarily block access to the site. The request followed a court order to block NewsBin 2, a site offering links to downloaded pirated material. For anybody who didn't know what NewsBin 2 was, that was a newsgroup indexer where you could click links and pull shit down from newsgroups. Most people don't have newsgroups accounts anymore, so the ISP said that they would not block the site unless a court order was made, as is now the case. Virgin Media told BBC it will now comply with the request, but warned such measures are, in the long term, only part of the solution. As a responsible ISP, Virgin Media complies with the court orders addressed. Of course you do. It's like, yeah, no, we don't have a choice here. The court told us to do it. addressed to the company, but strongly believes that changing consumer behavior to tackle copyright infringement also needs compelling legal alternatives, such as our agreement with Spotify, to give customers access to great content at the right price. The Pirate Bay was launched in 2003, blah, 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 blah. Okay. I've got another story from Torrent Freak on the same thing, and the reason I want to read it is because it's essentially the Pirate Bay's response.
Yeah.
And it's really funny. Last Friday, the UK High Court ruled that several of the country's leading ISPs must censor the Pirate Bay, having ruled in February that the site and its users break copyright on a grand scale. Blah, 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 everything we just talked about. On hearing the news, the Pirate Bay insider told Torrent Freak that the measure will do very little to stop people accessing the site and predicted that the free advertising would only increase traffic levels. It's not possible to buy advertising articles from leading UK publications such as the BBC, Guardian, and Telegraph. Bullshit. But yesterday, the Pirate Bay news was spread across all of them and dozens besides for free. The news was repeated around the UK, Europe, and most of the world, reaching millions of people. The results for the site were dramatic. Thanks to the High Court and the fact that the news wars on the BBC, we had 12 million more visitors yesterday than we've ever had before. A Pirate Bay insider informed Torrent Freak today. We should write a thank you note to the BPI. Yeah. I love these guys. Talk about cheek, right?
Right, that's awesome.
The Pirate Bay told us that by taking a range of measures, any blocking techniques employed by the ISPs can be overcome. First, they advise that the most simple solution is to use a VPN, such as iPredator or other similar services that carry no logs. We've talked about those in Digital Dojos, by the way. These VPN providers cost money, but there are free solutions too. Companies such as VPN Reactor offer a free service that is time-limited, around 30 minutes per session, but that's plenty of time for users to get on Pirate Bay and download the torrent files they need. Once they have the torrent files in the clear, the blocking has been bypassed. Even with the VPN turned off, the downloads will complete. Yeah, because that's how BitTorrent works.
Right.
Pirate Bay also recommends the use of Tor, but only for the initial accessing of their website and the downloading of the .torrent files. Torrent clients themselves should never be run over Tor. The system isn't designed for it, and besides, the transfer will be pitifully slow. The Pirate Bay also points to I2P as a further unblocking option. I love this. It's like, yeah, thanks for the advertising. Here's how to get around the blocks. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. Also, they recommend switching your DNS to OpenDNS or Google instead of your IP or instead of your ISP if they're censoring it via DNS.
Yeah.
So I love their response. It's like, thanks for the free advertising, jackasses. I mean,
that's cool. That's.
isn't it?
You know, I mean, going back to your previous statement on the story was that whenever they said basically we need to change consumers' viewpoints or whatever, you know.
I think we need to change the laws.
You know, that's one thing. Two, I think it's not necessarily the consumer as it is the artists, not even necessarily the artists, but the people who distribute the music, okay? The labels. We need to change their business tactics so it lowers the price.
Well, the problem isn't really even that, because let's be real, you're always going to have piracy, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, can never get rid of it.
Yeah, it's always going to be there. So whoop-de-fucking-do, right? But it's usually a small amount, and who cares? What they need to do is they need to fix copyright law, because they're suing people over music that's been out for a century.
Mm-hmm.
Or really bad rap. And if you're pulling down really bad rap and getting sued, I've got no sympathy for you, because most of it's not good. But, you know, at least the complaints I see on a regular basis. So, anyways, moving on. This next one is actually from the Tor Project. And it's kind of a big deal, especially because we've mentioned Tor in the past several Digital Dojos. A user has discovered that a severe security bug in Firefox related to WebSockets bypassing the SOX proxy DNS configuration. This means that when connecting to a WebSocket service, your Firefox will query the local DNS responder rather than only communicating through its proxy, Tor, as it is configured to do. This bug is currently present in the Tor browser bundles, version 2235-9 on Windows, 2235-10 on OS X and Linux. To fix this DNS leak security hole, they've got some steps in there, basically going in there and turning off WebSockets to get around the bug. It's a bug in Firefox where requests will be made outside of your proxy settings, and with Tor, that's kind of a big deal because that can reveal what you're looking at through Tor. And, you know, from further on the site, when visiting certain websites, for example, bitcoincharts.com with JavaScript enabled, a DNS request for the domain is made without going through Tor. This website is the only one that I know of that it happens. This is running the latest Tor browser bundle. I got this from the bug track entry. Properly verified against the GPG signature. Enabling NoScript to block all JavaScript seemed to make the DNS request go away. This is verified by restarting Tor, then disabling JavaScript before visiting the site. Now, it should be pointed out it's just a DNS request, and you know, depending on what you're looking at, if it's if you're posting stuff to Twitter or Facebook over Tor because you're in a repressive regime or whatever, I don't know how bad that is. But all that can reveal is the site you're looking at, not necessarily the content you're sending across the wire.
Right.
So, I don't know. I guess if you're looking at some god-awful porn site and you were really hoping your ISP didn't know that, that could be a problem. But,
Well, it comes back to what I've said in the past. A, own it and be proud of it, whatever you're looking at. Or B, don't do something you don't want other people not to know.
Well, that was the point. That was one of the points we made when we were talking about hiding stuff from your ISPs. Do you really care?
That's right, you know? I don't care.
So, but yeah, there's a bug in Firefox that's affecting the Tor bundle. So just something to be aware of if you're using Tor. This next one is from Ars Technica, and this is one of the reasons we're looking at Skype alternatives. The other being some of the constant call problems you were having during some of the shows. Microsoft has drastically overhauled the network running its Skype voice over IP service, replacing peer-to-peer client machines with thousands of Linux boxes that have been hardened against the most common types of hack attacks, a security researcher said. The change, which Immunity Security's Kostya Korchinski, I was close, said occurred about 2 months ago, represents a major department from the design that has powered Skype for the past decade. Since its introduction in 2003, the network has consisted of supernodes, made up of regular users who had sufficient bandwidth, processing power, and other system requirements to qualify. These supernodes then transfer data with other supernodes in a peer-to-peer fashion. At any given time, there were technically a little more than 48,000 clients that operated that way. Korchinski's analysis, which has not yet been confirmed by Microsoft, at the time of this writing, actually it was confirmed later, but when they wrote this it wasn't, shows that Skype is now being powered by a little more than 10,000 supernodes that are all hosted by the company. It's currently not possible for regular users to be promoted to supernode status. What's more, the boxes are running a version of Linux using GR Security, a collection of patches and configuration designed to make servers more resistant to attacks. In addition to hardening them to hacks, the Microsoft-hosted boxes are able to accommodate significantly more users. Well, I would assume that's because people are sitting there playing Skyrim on them. Supernodes under the old system typically handled about 800 end users, Korchinski said, whereas the newer ones handle about 4,100 users and have a theoretical limit as many as 100,000 users. They're going on about how it's all right because it's better for security. You're not relying on end users and people with cable modems and that kind of stuff. But, you know, ever since the filtering of MSN, ever since Microsoft took over Skype, we've been waiting to see what they were going to do with it. Now, a Microsoft spokeswoman just released the following statement, which she attributed to Mark Ginelli, CVP, Skype Product Engineering Operations. As part of our ongoing commitment to continually improve the Skype user experience, we developed supernodes which can be located on dedicated servers within secure data centers. This has not changed the underlying nature of Skype's peer-to-peer architecture, in which supernodes simply allow users to find one another. Calls do not pass through supernodes. We believe this approach has immediate performance, scalability, and availability benefits for hundreds of millions of users that make up the Skype community. So in other words, Microsoft said, yeah, we're doing that. Now, what that means is the systems that handled how your Skype client would find your buddy's Skype client so they could open a direct connection to each other and do a VoIP call, if you weren't both on public IPs, you would often hit supernodes to handle the routing, and you would set up NAT traversal. But the thing about the supernodes was if NAT traversal couldn't be established correctly through your router for one reason or another, they would actually play proxy. And if you ever figured out you were running as a supernode, you'd be like, wow, my bandwidth sucks. It's because Skype was sucking all of it up. So on one hand, it's kind of cool that that's not going to happen anymore. But on another hand, this is, you know, we've been waiting to see what Microsoft's going to do to Skype. And, you know, they're starting to bounce everything through centralized servers again, as opposed to peer-to-peer.
And on the ass hand, you know, why the hell haven't they fixed the problems with Skype and just completely redone it? Because, I mean, you know, they want to. And they want to track everything, fine, track everything. But, you know, just make the freaking call quality better.
Well, I mean, Skype's one of the better ones out there as far as free call quality goes, which is why we've been using it.
Right.
But, I mean, we've gotten a lot of dropouts. You know, we'll get random syntax wrapping. We'll get, I mean.
I think he does that on purpose.
He probably does. He's got like one of those Xbox lag switches or something to make it do that. But, yeah, that or he's just sitting there saying the same thing over and over and over again, thinking, you know, so it's like, I'm going to pretend to have Skype connection issues. I don't know.
Or deep down, he has hard time talking, and he has maybe he stutters. I don't know.
Yep. My soundboard isn't quite working the same. I'm using a different controller again.
Soundboard stutter.
But I can make it do that. So, anyways.
Nice.
Yeah, it's mildly different control scheme. It's actually the old control scheme. I have to actually hold the button down for it to keep playing the sound clip, which is actually good. Because that means I can kill it in the middle of a sound clip. And like, you know, earlier when I'd hit a button and be like, stop! So,
yeah,
I just got to get used to it. But, anyways, moving on. Next one's up from Wired. A Canadian company that makes equipment and software for critical industrial control systems planted a backdoor login account in its flagship operating system, according to a security researcher, potentially allowing attackers to access the devices online. The backdoor, which cannot be disabled, is found in all versions of the rugged operating system made by RuggedCom, according to independent researcher Justin W. Clark, who works in the energy sector. The login credentials for the backdoor include the static username factory, that was assigned by the vendor, and it can't be changed by customers, and a dynamically generated password that is based on the individual MAC addresses or media access. Okay, they explain what a MAC address is of this specific device. Attackers can uncover the password for a device simply by inserting the MAC address, if known, into a simple Perl script that Clark wrote. MAC addresses for some devices can be learned by doing a search with Shodan, a search tool that allows users to find internet-connected devices such as industrial control systems and their components using simple search terms. Clark, who is based in San Francisco, says he discovered the backdoor after purchasing two RuggedCom devices, an RS-900 switch and an RS-400 serial server, on eBay for less than $100 and examining the firmware on them. So he dumped out the firmware and said, hey, there's factory backdoors on here.
So I guess, I mean, I understand maybe why the company does what they do as far as putting the backdoors in. But, you know, to make it so that they can't be closed, that part, you know, that's kind of underhanded from the company side.
Yeah, I hate seeing that. I mean, I've encountered these. I've discovered backdoors in systems.
I agree. It makes it easy for, you know, the technicians to come out and, you know, troubleshoot, do whatever they need to do to get the customer back up and running.
Oh, okay, I tell you, it's great when you're on the conference call with the, say, digital signage provider, and you're like, yeah, this username and password that was on the system sucks balls. Can we get this changed? And they come back, how did you get that password? Yeah, I've done my own share of backdoor discovery, and it's in a lot of systems. You want to have some fun, scan some high number ports on laser printers. Yeah, even if they got a password set, you can a lot of times FTP or TFFTP into some high number ports on certain copier scanners. Because if the reason there's backdoors in there is if you go in and set some crazy password and then forget it, the idea is the manufacturer can still get in there and reset it back to default. But the problem is the scheme they use to develop these things sucks. So suddenly you can find these things and publish them, and you have things like this where you have people freaking out.
So how many backdoors have you probed?
Well, if we're talking just in computer systems alone, I think I've probably discovered 5 or 6, but if we're talking about in general, we can probably quadruple that number. But that's not the point.
That's true. And slide it on to the next one.
A rocket snail? Yes, that's right. Analog made an anal sex joke, and I played along.
Oh, God, the meds.
Next one up is from Ars Technica. This is kind of fun. A company has substantially ported Google's Java-based Android software to use C# and the .NET framework, a move that could be the first step towards creating an Android-like operating system that avoids the legal entanglements with Oracle. Android's primary application environment is based on the Java technology first developed by Sun, now owned by Oracle. Google's decision to use Java in Android has resulted in a decidedly inconvenient and potentially expensive copyright and patent lawsuit with Oracle. Java wasn't, however, the company's only option. It briefly considered, then ignored, Microsoft's .NET runtime and C# programming language. Like Java, .NET and C# under a convenient, modern, object-oriented language and API. Unlike Java, much of C# and .NET are covered by ISO standards, which legally binding commitments from Microsoft not to sue implementers on the specifications for patent infringement. While Microsoft's own .NET implementation is the best known and most widely used, there is a high-quality third-party implementation called Mono. That's what you use on Linux. Since May last year, the development and maintenance of Mono has been handled by Xamarin, a startup company created by core Mono developers after a long and complicated history with Novell and Attachmate. Xamarin has two important products, Mono for Android and Mono Touch, bringing Mono development to Android and iOS respectively. I might have to look into that. I didn't know they had an iOS Mono library. Anyways, Xamarin developers started a Skunkworks project to port the Java parts of Android to use C# and .NET instead. The result is Zobot OS. To create Zobot OS from a million or more lines of Java, Xamarin used the Java to C# conversion tool Sharpen. The tool... The company had developed and improved Sharpen so it could handle the complexity of the Android code base, and a small portion of the code had to be manually ported, especially parts that interface the underlying operating system. Zobot OS is not just interesting because of its Java avoidance. Mono performs well and can run .NET programs much faster than the equivalent Java programs on Android. The Mono virtual machine is quite mature when compared to Google's Divlik virtual machine, and is capable of much more extensive optimization than Divlik. There are also some performance-enhancing features.
I think it's probably Dalvik.
There are also some performance-enhancing features that Microsoft added to .NET that Java lacks, such as the generics that are built into the runtime and low-overhead value types for small objects. Xamarin says that Zobot OS is only a research project and it doesn't intend to maintain it as a standard project. Instead, it is using the work done to create Zobot OS, such as the improved version of Sharpen, and improved graphics library that were used to the operating system rather directly than going to Java to improve its Mono for Android project. So in other words, they did this more as a research project to make their other Mono tools better, which I kind of like that use of them, though. It's like, yeah, we're just going to port Android.
that part's cool.
While Xamarin does not intend to develop Zobot OS further, it is like Android, open source and published under the Apache language. License. So, in other words, they've open sourced what they've done. So, since they've ported it to Mono and .NET, how long before you see Android on, say, Windows mobile phones?
That's true.
You were going to say something before I cut you off at the end of the story.
No. I was just saying I like the idea that they're, you know, getting away from the Google base. However, this story was filled with several words and it just started getting funny. I mean, maybe it is the medication, you know, Zobot and Dalvik and, you know, Sharpen and, yeah.
Well, I get the joke with Sharpen. You're going to see Sharp, haha, funny.
Yeah, right.
But some of the other names, I'm totally guessing at how to pronounce them. And I've
Where
had
the
lots
heck
of
they
vodka.
Come up with them though. That's the funny part, you know.
It's ecstasy. Like... You take ecstasy and you just start saying stuff aloud while recording it. Then you review it while saying it, like, "Hey, I made up a word. Let's use that."
I mean, yeah, maybe. I don't know.
A year later, you just get your employees hopped up on whatever meds you find in the medicine cabinet.
Well, I mean, you know, like I said, being on meds, these names do start to be very funny very quickly. So, but with that, getting back to the actual story itself, I mean, I do like the idea behind it. I would like to see where it actually goes. And, you know, you know, again, having a third party, you know, application like the Mono out there, to that way would allow, you know, additional development, you know, outside of the fact of having, you know, the standard, you know, Apple.
It's a version of Android that's not quite as tied to Google as So I could see some interesting things coming out of the work. I'm not sure that we're going to see a .NET version of Android floating around very often, although it would be really cool to see Microsoft pick this up and do something with it, because it's their code base.
Yeah, that's true.
And not only that, that aside, they've got a tool that converts Java to .NET. That's cool.
That is very cool.
Because I know of a ton of old Java applications out there that are written to, you know, 1.5, whatever, and they won't run when you update to the next dot release because, you know, they do a check. But if you could take that source code, run it, put it on .NET, now you've got stuff that'll run on a modern operating system and you don't have to sit there and use that legacy Java implementation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think some of the later Firefoxes are actually disabling Java if it's not up to date. I know Chrome goes nuts if you try to play Minecraft and your Java's not up to date. So,
very true. I think it would be cool to see, you know, with Google trying to make some of their own phones, maybe that they get away from the standard Android Google base and maybe create something specific, something new, you know?
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see. I mean, there's lots of room to play with the ideas right now on it, so. All right. This next one is from the New York Times. This is a fun story. In what is shaping up to be an academic battle of the titans, one that offers vast new opportunities for students and around the world, Harvard and the MIT on Wednesday announced a new nonprofit partnership known as edX to offer free online courses from both universities. Harvard's involvement follows MIT's announcement in December that it was starting an open online learning project, MITx. Its first course, Circuits and Electronics, began in March, enrolling about 120,000 students, and some 10,000 of whom made it through the recent midterm exam. That's a hell of a drop. Those who complete the course will actually get a certificate of mastery and a grade, but no official credit. Well, who cares if you got a certificate saying you did it? Who cares if you're not getting university credit?
Yeah, no kidding.
Similarly, the edX courses will offer a certificate but not credit. Harvard and MIT have a rival. They are not the only elite universities planning to offer free, massively open online courses, which these people are calling MOOCs, M-O-O-C, as they are known. This month, Stanford, Princeton, University of Pennsylvania, and the University of Michigan announced their partnership with a new commercial company, Coursera? I think it's Coursera. With 16 million in venture capital. Meanwhile, Sebastian Thurn, the Stanford professor who made headlines last fall with 160,000 students signed up for his artificial intelligence course, has attracted more than 200,000 students to his six courses offered at his new company, UDA City. What is with these words?
Hey, that's what I'm saying.
Need more vodka. Anyways, the technology for online education with video lesson segments, enabled quizzes, immediate feedback, and student-paced learning is evolving so quickly that those in the new ventures are saying the offerings are still experimental. My guess is that what we end up doing 5 years from now will look very different from what we do now, said Provost Alan M. Garber of Harvard, who will be in charge of the university's involvement. EdX, which sounds like a sex site, is expected to offer its first five courses this fall. Bad joke. Which will be overseen by a nonprofit organization governed equally by the two universities, each of which has committed $30 million to the project. The first president of edX will be Arnett Agrawal. It sounds like a role-playing name, Agrawal. Director of MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, and who's led the development of MITx program. At Harvard, Dr. Garber will direct the effort, with Michael D. Smith, Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, working with faculty members to develop and deliver courses. MIT and Harvard officials said they would use the new online platform not just to build a global community of online learners, but also to research teaching methods and technologies. So, the reason I throw this story in, MIT and Harvard are offering free education online.
I'm signing up.
This is cool.
Yeah, heck yeah. I mean, I'm honestly going to sign up. I'm going to go look at this and find out what I can take. That's awesome.
Well, they've got a circuits and design course on there. You can learn basic electronics and get a certificate in it. Now, that's right. It's not university credit, but you can still...
Who cares?
You've got a certificate. You can put that shit on a resume.
That's right. And honestly, you know, yeah, okay, paper does allow people to get jobs, but, you know, a certificate is almost as good. Right. It's almost as good as an actual university, you know, actual degree.
It's probably enough to get you in the door for an interview. If you say, definitely. Look, I've got these four certificates from Harvard, you know, or EdX or EDX or whatever it was. You know, you've got those on your list. HR will probably let you in the door. And, you know, most companies will still give you that technical aptitude test they do.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it's, you prove you know your shit. Who cares, you know, if you've got a degree or certificate? Hell, most what do you think most certifications that cost money are? They're certificates.
Yep.
I've got a handful of them. They mean approximately jack. So.
Very true.
I've interviewed people that had a ton of certificates and couldn't work a freaking telephone. But that's neither here nor there.
I see one problem with your story.
Yeah.
Michael D. Smith needs to change his name because his name's too bland.
Yeah, all these other interesting names we've been doing all night.
It's Garbert at Harvard.
Okay, we're going to rename Michael D. Smith right now. Let's go with... crap, now I can't think of anything. Pick a name out of, like, you know, Diablo or something. You can, you know, Azariel or something. Just rename him. It's like, your name is not interesting enough. We're going to fix that for you. Here's your new ID.
Nice.
Oh, if I worked in the ID center, I would so do that shit. It's like, I don't think your name is interesting enough. We're fixing that for you.
Random.
And we're photoshopping your picture, too, to take care of some of these other problems we see. By the way, you now have green skin. I suggest you paint yourself before you get pulled over.
just have a random D&D character name generator there for orc names.
Oh, hell. All right, so let's move into this.
Me love you long time.
I've got a new idea for a Digital Dojo opening bumper, I guess is what you would call that. So I'm going to see if I can work that up, just because we've been using that one for a while.
What, a video of the Asian lady now?
Yeah, that'd be wouldn't that be great? We could get that in a podcast. Video of the Asian lady.
There you go.
Of course, you'd have to be careful. We have syntax on the call. All you hear in the background is wanking. But anyways.
And?
Fair point. Yeah. He's not on the call. He can't defend himself. He actually declined being on the show tonight. So
that's his loss.
Yep. Anyways, so what I came up with for Digital Dojo this week, I thought was pretty good. So just where the hell do you learn this stuff anyways? You know, most normal people, and I use that term very loosely, I talk to, you know, they think that it's, you know, computer skills or, you know, hacking specifically, but, you know, anything with a computer is like this dark art that you have to be initiated into a secret club and you meet in dark corners of the internet and exchange how to do this stuff and, you know, you're branded with some seal of, you know, Solomon or whatever at birth and granted magic powers to use the computer.
But you are.
Well, we can't give away all the secrets.
We don't talk about that.
Yeah, we don't talk about the branding. We also don't talk about the hazing, and we don't talk about the secret sigils you put on the bottom of your computer to keep viruses out. Or the Steve Jobs zombie that we have to put down once a week. But that's not here. Anyways.
That aside, though, what the heck's with the TM in your show notes?
I don't know. I just thought that was funny. Yeah, I've got dark art trademark on there. So.
Okay. Anyways.
Yeah, I find that I was at work and I was writing my show notes and that was quite hilarious. Probably because I was looking at a bunch of marketing material for some stuff. So it's like it just kind of slipped in there. Anyways, so in truth, almost everything you need, damn near everything you need to get started in doing deeper computer stuff, basic hacking, tools, really knowing what's going on in a system, it's all out there for free. And I don't mean piracy. I mean, most of the stuff is open source, free, on blogs. So, and actually, if you go to the show notes, I have a collection of my usual sources where I go to look up stuff. Honestly. So, most of the tools, and you know, most of the tools that aren't free, because most of them are free and open source, and or most of the ones that aren't free, they either have a demo, a trial, a community edition, or an educational edition that's hugely discounted, if not free itself. And usually, I found the open source tools are just as good, if not better, than the commercial tools in a lot on this area.
Right.
So, and for Microsoft software, because you will need copies of Windows, TechNet accounts are generally the way to go. Those are fairly cheap compared to buying the licenses for all this stuff. And a lot of these tools, you can get educational discounts. And if you can scrape up a .edu email address, you can get a lot of stuff freer on the cheap. And, you know, at the end of the day, if you really need a book or a certain piece of software to test, there's always the Pirate Bay. If you are going to use pirated software for testing, I don't really, you know, I've never really had any kind of a moral problem with the idea of pulling down a pirated copy of some database server or application server just to do testing. Because it's not like you're putting it in a production environment and making money from it. You're literally just figuring out how the damn thing works. So I'm not, I mean, yeah, it's illegal, but a lot of people do it. So that's out there. Just... But in all seriousness, access to almost everything you need to get started in doing, you know, deeper computer work, understanding how networking works, understanding how hacking works, what's really going on when somebody breaks into your systems, it's all free. It's all out there. You just have to know to look for it. That's one of the reasons why I get upset when people ask me, it's like, well, hey, you talk about how to do this stuff. You talk about how to break into systems and... You know, you talk about putting out videos showing people how to use some of the specific tools. Aren't you worried you're going to make a bunch of script kiddies? It's like, well, the script kiddies are already there. Everything's already out there. If I can get, you know, more people aware of what's going on, that's more people who can actually help defend.
This is true.
So, anyway, so it's just like any other skill. It's more about practice and time investment than anything else. I mean, you know, sure, having the right mindset helps. Having... you know, some talent for a computer helps, but in the end, it's all about banging your head against the keyboard till you get what you want. You know, get your hands on systems and software, tear it apart, learn to recognize it, and run from there. And one of the things I like to do is I like to recognize, I really make a point of trying to look and see what systems are running what. I had some examples here in the show note. You ever see an ATM running, you know, with a Windows blue screen on it? Because I have. Or a photo booth, like in the mall, you sit down and put, you know, the dollar in, and it takes like four pictures. If you catch one of those rebooting, a lot of times you'll see, I remember seeing an ancient copy of Red Hat. It was like Red Hat 5 and the old Lilo bootloader screen that was on the screen. It was hilarious. A lot of airport media runs Linux too, by the way. So if you catch them doing a reboot of that system, you might see a bit of the Linux bootloader going by. You ever catch this glimpse of a point of sale system? A lot of times you'll see a hacked up KDE desktop or a, you know, ASA 400 terminal. So those are interesting too. And that's something I do personally is when I'm walking around, I try to get a glimpse at what, especially some of these embedded systems, is just what other people are running to see if I recognize them. And it's really fun when I'm home visiting the family and they're watching TV, I see a computer screen and I can tell them not only what the software they're running on that screen is, but how they made it look like that. And, you know, of course, my family thinks I'm crazy, but knowing that means that I know what's running under it, which means I have a clue of how to start if I, say, wanted to hack into it, right? So,
yeah.
And part of the way you get the recognition of the different systems out there is to do the grunt tech work. You know, go do system fixes. Go do software installs. You know, work a help desk. It sucks. It is so crushing work. But, you know, there's not really much of another way. You know, go admin a box for a year. There's not really another way to get that kind of hands-on knowledge of how a system really works other than to just do it. And the other thing you want to pick up is not just what these systems are, but how people use them. You know, where do people store their shit on computers? And one of the best things to do is learn where the desktop folder is on various operating systems, because 9 times out of 10, that's where everything is.
That is true.
Oh, yeah. No, you go in, you sit down on some, you know, somebody's system, and, you know, you got, you know, some English teacher or nurse or whatever. Everything's on the fucking desktop. I mean, everything.
It's like, and, you know, you have. I find it funny. They say, oh, I know exactly where everything is. Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you've got a My Documents folder. You can file this stuff away when you're done with it. It's like, oh, no, I just, you know, have it on the desktop. It's like, oh, okay, well, whatever. But, you know, I mean, and you know, the computer doesn't stop you from doing that. If you want to be dumb with everything you put on the system, it'll do it.
That's true.
So learning these common behaviors is great. That way, when you get into a system, one of the first things I do when I get into a system is I go check the desktop folder. I check the desktop folder before I check My Documents. Because 9 times out of 10, everything I need to identify who owns a system is on the desktop. You know, you find some document they've written or something else, and they just save it right on the desktop. So, hell, I do it. I do it too on my personal computers. I've got stuff I've saved out on the desktop. It eventually gets moved off somewhere else, but you know, I mean, that's just, it's convenient. So,
and I agree with that saving, because I do the same thing. You know, like today I was working on a video training document for work, and it's just like, well, I just dumped the project file to the desktop and then walked away because I had to do some training courses for some people.
Sure.
And then had to come back, you know, a couple hours later, and I knew exactly where it was. I mean, I could just click on it, reopen it, but when I'm done at the end of the day and it's completed, yeah, the document, it goes in the appropriate folder.
Yeah, you file it away, but it's handy, yeah, to have it on the desktop where you're working with it. You see, a lot of people skip that step of filing it, yeah, away. They just have 100 things on their desktop.
So, you know, going out to people's houses or businesses when I used to do, you know, tech work on the side, and I'd be charging, you know, my own rate, not the company's rate or whatever, I would actually charge them more if they had a very cluttered desktop or if they had the old Hot Dogs Windows theme.
Okay, that's, I like that. It's like, wow, you're an idiot. I'm charging you more because I can just look at your computer and see this is going to be a pain in the ass. I like, yes, that.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, when you're first picking up a system, you know, I kind of outlined the process I use when I'm attacking something for the first time. You know, I'll get in my lab and I'll build a server or a system, you know, to get an idea of what it is and how it works. And then I'll break it a few times from the administration console. I'll throw data at it and see what it does with it. I'll pick apart what files it writes to the hard drive. I mean, this is all simple stuff. You can do this in an hour. It sounds like it takes a lot of work, but it really doesn't. You know, pull down the system, drop it into place, go take a look at its program files folder, see what's in there, open the application up, do stuff in it, look at what it wrote out to the hard drive. It doesn't make any sense. You know, open stuff up in Notepad, see where the ASCII text is, see what's in it. It's not a complicated thing, but once you start to get an idea of how a program works, see, you're not, the goal here is not to become an expert in, like, you know, I can open up this file in a hex editor and make the program do X, Y, and Z. No, no, no. You're just trying to get a general idea of what the program is and how it works. You don't need to know the details. You don't need to know, you know, the memory addresses it uses, for God's sakes, or whatever. That's what scripting is for. But, you know, you need to know how to find it. That's not what I'm saying there. But, you know, you write the script once and you move on. You don't sit there and memorize memory addresses. Nobody does that, right? I mean, if you've got one you use all the time. But anyways, so once you've got a good understanding of how the program works, then you start hitting it from the outside. Hit it with an appropriate client and see what it does. You know, if it's a web app, open it up in a web browser, see what it does. You know, get an idea for how to legitimately use it. Then try hitting the service with an inappropriate client and see what it does. Try telnetting to an email server sometimes. You might be surprised with what you get. You know, a lot of times I'll open up a connection to a server in PuTTY or Telnet or Netcat and see what comes back. After I've set up a server, you know, I'll run Nmap against it, see what ports it's opened up. I'll run Nessus against it and see, you know, what Nessus and Nmap report services are. It's amazing what hardcore, crazy expensive corporate software is built on top of. Apache Tomcat and your various, you know, free SQL servers come up a lot. As in, I know some very expensive top dollar corporate software that is sitting on Apache Tomcat, which is an open source project. It's free.
Mm-hmm.
So they're taking open source software and building their product on top of it. Which means if you find a hole in Apache Tomcat, and you know your high dollar corporate software is sitting on top of Apache Tomcat, well, great, you've got a hole in it. Whether or not there's a problem in the corporate software, you can still get in the box, right?
Yeah.
Especially because a lot of times, sure, the corporate software is up to date, but they used a version of Tomcat that's 4 years old to build it, and they haven't been bothering to patch that because they're afraid they'll break the app. So the point of all that is to sit down and figure out what a program is and what it's really doing on a system, right? Is it really a wrapper for a SQL server? There are a lot of, you know, from like in the educational space, a lot of people use Banner and Blackboard. You realize those are a set of scripts wrapping an Oracle database, right? That's all they are.
Wow. So, oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, that's all they are. Is they're a set of scripts wrapping an Oracle database. Now, they're scripts that add an API. But, and don't get me wrong, it's important functionality. But that's all they do, is they wrap a database.
Huh.
So...
That's interesting, yeah.
Now, granted, when I say that's all they do, that's still a very useful function. Don't get me wrong. But when you realize that's all these scripts are, and you're like, you're paying how much for that? But it's amazing the number of corporate software that is, you know, something you could whip up in Python in an hour. I mean, it's... But,
wow.
You know, I'm not a programmer, so I'm not going to... Well, I program, but I'm not a programmer. If you don't, does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
right.
I don't do it every day. The code I write is rather messy, but I mean, when it's like, wow, that's something you could, you know, automate quickly. It's like, huh.
Yes, it is messy, by the way.
Oh, you've looked at some of that.
Oh, I've looked at some of your code.
Yeah,
you don't comment.
But it works. The software fucking works.
But you don't comment. Damn it.
I'll have to ask you what you were looking at and see if I can help you out with that later, because some of it is a mess, and you're right. I don't. Actually, I was looking at something I wrote at work to see if I could rewrite it, clean it up a little bit. The comments are in the wrong place. Like, I wrote out a framework in the comments before I wrote the code so I could get my ideas straight, and I've got whole chunks of code where the comment above it is, like, for something else. It's just like,
oh, that's awesome. So you actually commented something, but it's the wrong comment?
Yeah, the comment's in the wrong place, yeah. No, it's a correct comment. It just should be, you know, 100 lines down the code or something like that.
Oh, so that's awesome.
Isn't that great? So, yeah. But I fully admit this. I'm not a coder. I'm a packet monkey. So,
and you know, the sad part is a lot of coders are the same way, though. They don't comment well. And, you know, if you're really going to do code and... You know, really get good at it, and then you want to make sure that you are a not necessarily well known, but you know, you have some clout within that community, and you're looking at the open source lines, code with comments, good comments.
Well, some of the programming books always are like, you know, comment every line. Fuck that shit.
No. You
comment
don't have to
your
do
blocks.
That. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's you don't want to give every line, because at that point you become pretentious and you are...
Coders being pretentious? No.
But it's more or less, you know, giving a broad overview of what you're actually, this section is supposed to accomplish.
Sure.
Because, I mean, granted, there's probably a billion ways to do it within the code. You know?
Oh, I mean, that's the point of code. It's just what method you pick.
So...
Anyways, so just some key points I'd come up with when you're experimenting with this stuff. Always sandbox, no exceptions. If you don't know what something's going to do, sandbox it. You know, you don't want to break anything legitimate. You don't want to have something get out of your network and start wreaking havoc. I can't tell you the number of stories there are out there about people who were writing a virus to experiment and the damn thing got loose on the internet because they weren't paying attention to what they were doing. So... Always sandbox. Always put it together a test environment. Always sandbox. And if you're running code that you don't trust, like you pulled it down off Millworm or whatever, air gap your test network and keep an eye on it. Because it's like, gee, I'm running this code I've never seen before, and it's making callbacks to some server on the internet. It's like, what do you think's really trying to happen there? So, you know, just skim the code. If you pull down code off Millworm, skim it first. See if you can catch it, what it's doing. It's a lot easier to read code than it is to write code. Even if you don't know the programming language it's in, skim it anyways. Most of these things are fairly easy to figure out. So, you know, just because you don't know a language doesn't mean you can't pick out the structure of it and go, that's trying to connect to some server I've never seen before. And, oh, look, it's formatting C. people publish, you know, especially for exploits, people publish code like that. That's just nasty. Because they don't, you know, they don't like security researchers, or they don't like people. They're like, oh, this is my exploit. I'm not giving this away, so I'll put out some bullshit code that doesn't do anything but trashes your hard drive. So,
yeah.
And, you know, have a test network. If you don't share your home network, you could just use your home network and just be aware that you might trash a machine you use every day. It's like, you know, it's good to build a separate network to test on. That way, you know, you don't take out, you say, your gaming station or your studio station or whatever you work on, right? I guess some people, you know, if you've only got one computer and you've only got, you know, your cable modem hooked up to it via USB line or direct Ethernet line or whatever, use virtual machines. Separate your stuff. So, using somebody else's network is a bad idea.
but I disagree.
I think it's a great idea. If you don't know what the code is going to do, if you're going to trash somebody else's network, you know, if you find somebody else's network, it's generally not a great idea to trash it. That's a good way to get yourself in trouble. But
hey,
but
you know what? Now they can't be sued.
That's right. You've got the ruling that they're not responsible. So, I've got in the show notes here, using somebody else's Wi-Fi is a bad idea. But anyways, just because if you trash them, you know, trashing somebody else's machine just because they don't know how to secure it, it's not cool. If you're going to get into somebody else's machine because they don't know how to secure it and you're not being friendly, at least cover your tracks well. You know, make sure they're not going to get in trouble for shit you're doing. If you are being friendly, leave them a note. Seem like, hey, you know what? You might want to do this, this, and this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can use virtual machines, you know, VMware, VirtualBox. Especially VMware Workstation, you can really go in and get hardcore with the network configs and set up virtual air gapping. I mean, it's not real air gapping, but it's close enough, right? Mm-hmm. So,
I think for the average Joe Schmo, I think VirtualBox is the way to go, you know, virtual machining, you know.
Oh, whether yeah. VirtualBox yeah, or... No, you get you a machine with decent power, you can run your attack machine and a couple of host machines and be good to go and just get an idea for this stuff, right? I mean, it's not black magic. It's not like you shake your dick at the keyboard and go ooga booga booga and get a root shell. And I've been trying to explain that to people. It's like, no, there's an actual methodology to this, but... You know, at work, you get people who are just amazed by it. And it's just like, you know, here, you want a root shell? Here you go. And it's just like, they think it's some magic black art that you've, you know, I don't know, given up a testicle or something for. It's like, no way. Just go download it. But anyways, so I've got a list here of a lot of the sites I like to use when I'm trying to look up something or a project or whatever. So you got darkreading.com and isc.sans.org. Both of these are SANS Institute websites. Dark Reading is more of a blog, and ISC is the Internet Storm Center. They've got a collection of IP addresses they've gotten complaints on. They've got sort of a blog. They kind of keep track of the health of the internet on ISC. So both of those are good for keeping up to date with what's going on. Of course, irongeek.com, especially the con videos, those have a lot of good information in those. Packetstormsecurity.org, they've got a tools section that's great. They keep a blog going as well. SecurityTube.net. Now, this is fun. YouTube has tons of videos talking about how to hack into shit, but it's usually put out by some 12-year-old who doesn't really know what they're doing. It's like, oh, go download this program, and then you can hack into networks. It's like, well, do you know what the program's doing? No. This is why you run your test network, so you know if you're going to break shit. But because if you break shit, you can't use it. Just, you know. Mm-hmm. But SecurityTube.net is a video site like YouTube that's dedicated to tutorials for, you know, this is how you use a certain Metasploit module. This is, you know, Wi-Fi attack tools. And it's all It's all YouTube-style videos of how to do stuff. Now, one thing to watch out for on SecurityTube, there's a lot of foreign accents on there, so if you're not so good with accents, that might get under your skin. But if, you know, if accents don't bother you, go nuts. There's the subreddit on reddit.com of NetSec, N-E-T-S-E-C, you know, so /r/NetSec. There's usually good stuff in there. Of course, it's Reddit, so it's hit and miss, but that's usually a good place for keeping up with stuff. Darknet.org.uk, that site is full of tutorials and good blog posts. Excellent site to keep up with. Exploit-db.com. Now, the ExploitDB is great. If you've got a piece of software you've never played with before, but you've really got to get into it, especially if it's older, ExploitDB is the place to go because they'll tell you where the holes are. You can actually search, like you know, you've got whatever version of Adobe Acrobat on a client's machine. You can search ExploitDB and get an idea of where to start and how to attack this thing, right? Also, usually there's links to code. I didn't put it in here, but Milliworm has a lot of the attack code, too, and ExploitDB sometimes has links to it, so... and then finally, I've got in here pentest-standard.org. That's a wiki for the penetration testing standard that a lot of the high-end penetration testers have been putting together. Now, the wiki itself is not so great, but if you go into the technical specifications area of the wiki, they have got such a write-up on how to go in and explore a network and break into systems. It is pure gold if you want to see how to do this stuff. And of course, there's always Google. I don't have Google linked, but I don't think that's a link you need.
But so, I don't know the site.
Use the little box in Firefox. If all else fails, of course, you can go on forums and IRC channels and ask for help. But really, be sure that you've exhausted all your other avenues before you do that. It's really worth trying to teach yourself how to find what you're looking for if it's out there, or to do the research on your own if it's not. Because if you go in IRC all the time or forums all the time, it's like, yeah, hey, I'm trying to break into this Oracle box and I need some help. You know, they'll help you out at first when you're new. But eventually it's like, yeah, buddy, we're not doing your job for you. We're not helping you hack Hotmail for you. You get, you know, a lot of these people get requests every day from script kiddies who are like, yeah, I need to get into this Hotmail account. And, you know, eventually that shit gets old, right? So just keep that stuff in mind. But, you know, you can always ask for help as a last resort, but it really should be a last resort. You really should be able to find the answers for stuff you need on your own. So, I don't know, Analog, you think I've left anything else out here before we move on to the closing of the show here?
Sounds good to me, man.
All right, so moving on. Of course, always listen to the stream. We're constantly updating it. We've got funny stuff that plays on there all the freaking time. Sard is always looking for new music to add. We are doing the last I Have Nothing this Saturday. Pure Decking every Thursday. Between the Sheets is currently on hiatus. I'm not sure when that's coming back, but Syntax insists that it is. NR7, whenever somebody can find BSV and kick him. And finally, the Galaxy 15 radio site and Twitter handles. Use the feedback forms. We have feedback forms on the site. Use them. We like feedback. We like hearing that people are listening and they... you know, they have ideas about what we're talking about, or if we're just wrong. You know, if I said something wrong, let me know and shoot me a link so I can read up on it. My ego is not so big that I won't correct myself. So, you know, absolutely. If I say something
most
wrong.
Most of the time.
Right. You know, and if I want to admit I'm wrong, Analog will come after me with a ball peen hammer. So.
It's very convincing.
He's done it before. It fucking hurt. Anyways. And of course, we're going to have some time slots opening up. If you've got ideas for new shows, hit up the feedback forms and let us know what you got. We can work something out if you got something interesting. Maybe do a test show, send it to us. I'm open to new shows, especially with IHN ending. So, yeah, that's pretty much all I got. Analog, you got anything else you want to throw out before I hit the play button here?
Nah, I'm good, man. Let's do it.
Whoa, what the hell? What the hell? I just lost the, okay, our soundboard software just crashed.
That's interesting.
That's a first. Well, that's not good.
I can start singing.
Give me a second here to see if I can. We may just not have closing music tonight. Let me try something. No? Well, that's not even the right button. What the hell? Well, that's still working. Why the hell can't I play the music? Okay, well, no closing music tonight. The damn thing crashed out. So.
Good night, all. Good night. Have a great one.